All right, welcome back. So there was going to be a few new people here, but I don't think so. Is anybody new? So you are new. Okay, anybody else new?
I'm new too. I listened to the first two.
Oh, good. You both look familiar. Oh, maybe I saw you Sunday because I was here Sunday. Okay. All right, good. It doesn't matter even if you haven't been listening, so welcome. And we will do kind of a quick review of some of the topics that we discussed. So if you have any questions, don't hesitate to come up and ask, and I'm happy to go through that with you. And my name is Karen Mastriani. Ooh, I'll switch the thing so you can see my name. And, I apologize. That still says 2016. This is 2017. I added some slides. And I'm happy to share my email. I usually have it up there. So if you don't have it and you want it, I'm happy to share that. And there's been a couple of good questions, and some of those we'll talk about a little bit tonight. And so you always get something good out of that. So if you brought your phone in with you, if you'll make sure that it's on mute, if that's comfortable. If it's not, I know we all expect calls, and you'll miss something that could be important. So do whatever's comfortable to you. And I told the first night, I told everybody to make sure you have your phone on mute, and then my phone rings, and so it was pretty embarrassing. So you never know. So this is session 3. It's amazing to me that 5 seems insurmountable, and then it goes so quick. So it really does. And there is a lot to cover tonight. So we'll do kind of a brief review from last week, and then we are going to start talking about samsara and rebirth. But we'll go through a lot of the Four Noble Truths since we missed some of that. And a quick review of the mind, since rebirth, karma, the mind really do all really kind of interconnect, and you kind of layer each other. So it's good to have a good understanding of the mind, and then karma and rebirth kind of go together. And so we will talk about karma tonight as well, and what's virtuous actions, what's non-virtuous actions. So hopefully we'll get through a lot of that. And then it always seems like such a, I don't want to say hopeless thing, but you hear about these non-virtuous actions and you think, well, holy cow, I do those every minute. And it can be feel kind of hopeless. And it's not. We do a lot of virtuous things that we really, it's so easy to go to the negative, and that's where our mind goes, but we do virtuous things all the time. And then there is a way to purify when we do need that. So we'll briefly discuss that. But remember, anything we're discussing, I was talking to one of our nuns earlier today, and I said, it's not like we want anybody to drink the Kool-Aid. This is just really for information purposes and hopefully to help you along your journey and answer any questions. But there are classes that go much deeper than we could ever go in this. And then, so I encourage you, if you have that interest, that you take those, especially the Discovering Buddhism classes. But just coming on Sunday mornings, it's a real treat, and I know some of you were here Sunday. Geshe Tsongpo did Sunday's teaching, and they're always wonderful, but it just dovetails so nicely into what we're talking about here, because he was talking a lot about generosity and, you know, setting those intentions and making that wish. So let's go ahead and set our intentions, do a quick meditation. I came prepared for those who heard me hack through this last week. I went and got acupuncture treatment. I left here. I called her the next morning and said, you have got to help me. One treatment. It's amazing. Not perfect, but amazing. And then she just filled me up with lozenges to try. So I'm experimenting on you all. All right, so we'll set our intentions. We'll do a 9-round breathing meditation. We'll just try it. We'll go through it relatively quickly, because this can be a very slow, beautiful meditation. But I just want, we have a Meditation 101 class that piggybacks this one. So we finish this one, and then I think Meditation 101 starts the next week. There might be a week in between. It depends. But I encourage you to take that if you're interested in meditation and want to practice and try different things. Because this doesn't go into a lot of the teaching, but we'll still play. So, go ahead and let's just start by sitting comfortably. If you remember the 7-point posture, and I did bring handouts on the 7-point posture that I'll pass out. But you can sit in that. Bottom line is, make sure your spine is straight, that if you're in a chair, feet are flat on the floor. You can put a pillow under them if you can't get them flat. And you just want to pretend like your spine is just a stack of coins, and it's just being pulled by a string coming up through the crown of your head so that it's nice and straight. Tilt your chin down slightly. And then I invite you to close your eyes. And if that's not comfortable and you want to keep them open, at least look downward. And if you close your eyes and you've had a long day at work and you're just now sitting down from a frantic rush to get here, keep them slightly opened so you don't fall asleep. And just take a few nice deep breaths for me. Let go of any stressors from the day, any tension you're holding. And just rejoice in the fact that you made it here. Oh my gosh, what a gift you've given yourself. And just spend a second acknowledging that. So this 9-round breathing exercise is a simple but really profound method, and the idea is to clear the flow of energy in our body. This makes the mind more serviceable for meditation. It's said that there are these subtle energies in the body known as winds, and that the mind accompanies these winds. When the winds are serviceable, the mind is serviceable. So a 9-round breathing meditation is a way to bring balance to these winds, a balance to the mind, and then more neutral. So Geshe-la will often teach on this on Sundays, and he'll say, especially if you're having a lot of obstacles to meditating, because the idea is that you clear the channels that are in your body, and then that gets rid of or lessens the obstacles that we have. And we have thousands of channels. Some call them chakras, and they're throughout our body. But for this exercise, think about this. There's one main central channel, and then you have a right and a left channel on either side. And just imagine that these three channels join together just below the navel. And just focus for a second on that area where your three channels join. And the idea of this, and you can open your eyes and watch if you'd like as we do this, if you've never done it, we're going to start by blocking our left nostril. You use your ring finger because it's considered the cleanest finger. So your middle or your ring finger you can use. And if you're not comfortable blocking your nose, because some people just aren't because of allergies and whatever, imagine you are. So I'm not going to make anybody do that, but it's helpful. But I can imagine, and it works just fine when I do that. So block your nostril with your ring finger and breathe in through your right nostril. And the idea is you let go with your left, plug your right, and exhale through your left nostril. We're going to do that 3 times. So breathe in through your right. And then breathe out through your left. And as you're doing that, you imagine you're breathing in through that right channel. It's going over to your left, and you're breathing out through the left channel. And now we're going to switch. You're going to block your right nostril and breathe in through your left. Block your left and exhale. And again, visualizing air going into your left channel, crossing below, you're exhaling through your right. And then imagine you're breathing in through both nostrils. It's going down your central channel. And then as you exhale, you're exhaling through both your left and your right channels. And then sometimes it's actually good to repeat that 2 or 3 times. It's called 9 rounds because you're doing 3 on each side and then 3 in the center. And as you do it, you imagine that all impurities, distractions, mental dullness are expelled as you exhale. And just take a few deep breaths. And just imagine energy is flowing smoothly through all your channels. It's giving the nourishment you need to be here this evening, share and listen. And then just set your intentions for being here. Maybe it's to be open, to learn, to hear new ideas, squelch some curiosity for your own peace of mind and well-being. And then always set the altruistic intention that it's for your well-being as well as the well-being of those around you and all others. One nice visualization you can do either with this or instead of thinking 9 rounds, well, it's still good to think 9 rounds if you think breathing in clear, luminous light, and if the light is filling your body, and then as you exhale, you visualize getting rid of gray, smoky negativities. And that's a nice visualization you can do as well that fits in very nicely with the 9 round. Breathing. So, any questions, comments on that? Had any of you done that before? I've been teaching in the prison for 5 years, and I keep trying to introduce this, and they don't want anything to do with it. But the light and the gray, getting rid of the negativities, they like, and so I just call it something else, and they don't know that's what we're doing. It works out fine. I think they just don't like, and I don't blame them. They're so paranoid. Hepatitis A, I mean, all kinds of GI problems just goes through. They're like unbelievable. So they're just neurotic about what they touch, and putting their hands to their faces probably doesn't make them feel real comfy. So, quick review. We talked about several things in the first 2 weeks. One was Shakyamuni Buddha, and that he was a man, lived 2,500 years ago, born as a prince, Prince Siddhartha. He didn't suffer. He didn't suffer a day in his life, but he realized sufferings. He saw it, and he knew it was a matter of time before those he loved, himself, and all people in his father's kingdom were going to suffer. So he did different practices to develop his mind and succeeded to get rid of all negative obscurations, all the delusions. He saw reality. He saw existence as it really exists. You know, he saw reality. He saw the truth of that. And then he spent the next 40 years of his life teaching so that the rest of us could realize this path, learn what he learned, and become enlightened as well. And that is really our goal, is to reach enlightenment through this practice. We talked about our center and how we came to be here, and our founder and our director, Robbie Watkins, who continues to be our director here. And he's one of the instructors in the Discovering Buddhism program as well. Actually, Don Brown, our founder, is also one of the instructors in that program. Then we talked about the spread of Buddhism, how it started in India under that Bodhi tree, and all the teachings that the Buddha did, all 84,000 teachings that are all along our altar, and spread throughout Asia, and then kind of jumped and thankfully made it to the West in the 70s due to Lama Zopa Rinpoche. And on either side of His Holiness, Lama Yeshe's on this side and Lama Zopa Rinpoche's on the other. And they brought Buddhism here for us. His Holiness, and I've actually heard His Holiness say this, that Tibet was this isolated community. Not many people got to Tibet before 1959. And then since, you know, He went into exile, forced into exile. It opened, you know, it opened those borders, and you know, he says it really allowed the spread, you know, Buddhism to spread even further in the world. So good can happen no matter what. And then we talked about the Four Noble Truths, and we got through a lot of the first one last week, where the Four Noble Truths was the first turning of the wheel of Dharma that the Buddha taught in Deer Park. And he started with this because the Four Noble Truths are just foundation for why we want to learn the rest. Like, this is our motivation to realize that we are suffering and that there is a way out of this suffering. And he found the way. You know, he was showing us the way. So this first teaching on suffering and then ultimately happiness is really based on the fact that it's our responsibility. The whole philosophy in Buddhism is that suffering and happiness is in our minds, and we're responsible for that. It's not what happens out here. It doesn't mean that terrible things don't happen out here. They do. But it's how we react to those and how we take those in, how we view that, in karma, which we'll go into more tonight. So it's removing that habit of blaming others, blaming the system, what I rant and rave about often, and those do happen, but it's looking at our mind, and it's looking at, we use the term suffering, but dissatisfaction probably fits better. Just that icky, dissatisfied, many delights, which is wonderful, but no matter how often we practice delight, something can happen. It, kind of knocks us off our horse. So all those dissatisfactions. And the term used in Tibetan Buddhism is dukkha, D-U-K-A. They translate it into suffering, but it's not a perfect translation. And we talked about the three types of suffering. So the first noble truth was that suffering exists, the truth of suffering. And we went through in detail the three types of suffering. You have suffering of suffering, the real suffering, you know, from pain, sickness, illness, old age, death, etc., or any type of loss. And then you have the suffering of change, which we know that as well. And we know that on so many levels, that no matter how good things are, nothing's permanent, right? That'll be one of our topics. Things don't last. And, you know, you can think of it as if, you know, when you eating chocolate cake, the first three bites, maybe the first three pieces are delicious. And then you're sick, you know, and you immediately see that suffering of change. Or the new car that smells so good and you love the color, and then they come out with a prettier color that you didn't see when you bought yours. Or you scratch it. A friend of mine, I've never owned a new car, but a friend of mine bought a new car, walked out to the car dealer and just scratched it before he got in it. I thought, oh my gosh, what are you doing? He said, oh, it's going to scratch anyhow before I get out of the lot. I said, I'm getting it over with, and now it's done. So it's that suffering of change. And then the last one is that all-pervasive suffering. And we'll me moving. Do you want me to shut it off?
Is this Geshe-la's?
Yeah. And that one's already on.
My kids are, well, they're not kids, they're grown, but they're hearing impaired. Every time I put one of these on, I think of them when they were younger, that they had to wear a system in school. So when the teacher talked, it went directly to their hearing aids, and the teacher would forget to shut it off when they go to the restroom. So I'll never wear one of these on my belt. That, you know, made my giggle, and oh, anyhow, kids. So then you have this all-pervasive suffering, or compounded suffering. It's a little harder for us to get our arms around. Kind of falls into rebirth, but the idea is it's the ultimate delusion. It's the fundamental way that we see things that causes this delusion to cause us to come back into the cyclic existence. And so we come back where we're going to be born, we're going to suffer, we're going to get older, we're going to die, and then we're going to get reborn again. And we have that circle or that cyclic existence that happens until we cut the delusion and break this all-pervasive suffering, this compounded suffering that we have. And it really is due to our misconception of how things exist. And we'll touch on that, not really slightly tonight, but the next two classes we'll touch on that a lot more. So then we started on the second noble truth, which is that the truth of the cause of suffering, that there is a cause. And the Buddha says the cause is us. And that if we look at our minds, it's a matter of changing our minds and get rid of these six root afflictions. And the six root afflictions are ignorance, anger, attachment, pride, doubt, and wrong view. And ignorance is considered to be the ultimate root of suffering. I think Geshe Tsongpo said this Sunday. No, I can't remember. Geshe-la might have said it Wednesday. It might have been Geshe-la Wednesday night. But he was talking about if you think of a tree, a big, beautiful tree that has all these branches on it. And then he didn't know the word for kudzu, but he meant kudzu. He talked about a vine going all over it, and it's all intertwined. So you try to cut it down. He had some in his backyard. So you try to cut it down, so you find the smallest part that you can cut, and you break it from that branch. But the rest is still tangled in there and grows back, and it takes a lot of time to take an axe and cut each of those, everywhere that the kudzu has grown. And then the more it grows, the thicker and thicker that root gets. And so it takes a lot of work to, break that kudzu at the root. And that's what we're trying to get at with this ignorance, is this is the ultimate root. So we can look at our angry mind and all the negative things we do and gossip, but then ultimately we want to take care of those and keep cutting at that root, keep cutting at that root, so that once you cut at that root and you get rid of this ignorance, it all falls away. And then you have this big, beautiful tree without any kudzu growing all over it. So the idea is to get rid of the root of all suffering, which is this fundamental delusion of how we see things as existing, and that we see things as this independent reality outside of ourselves. And it's based on our karma, right? As well as our karma is part of this whole delusions that we have. And then anger, because we have angry reactions and outbursts. I should speak for myself. Maybe y'all don't. And it's never helpful. It's never good. And the harm that we do is tremendous. And in Buddhist philosophy, anger and aversion, you'll hear the word aversion because, there's things you just don't like and you almost recoil from them. And it's part of this anger process. And the whole idea is when attachment doesn't get what it wants. And so, and if you think about it, you think that what makes us angry, and it's usually because somebody did something that we didn't like or that we thought we were going to do X and now they want to do Y, so we didn't get what we wanted. And there's that real fine line there with anger. And so you keep looking at it. Where is this coming from? Where is this coming from? And often it's that because you didn't get that, whatever it was you were attached to. What we tend to do is exaggerate qualities, right? So with anger and aversion, we exaggerate that negative quality, and then we really lash out. Usually it's a person or an object that we really target and lash out to. And then attachment, we see this as kind of good. Now there's nothing wrong with pleasure, enjoyment, wanting nice things, being glad when you have nice things, and rejoicing when the weather's nice and you see a beautiful sunset, or you have that piece of chocolate cake and enjoying it, but then what do we do when it's gone? And that's part of attachment, that greedy, grasping, clinging kind of feeling. So we say, well, we love our family, and we love our friends, and we love our pets, and that's a good thing, right? But even think there. What do we do when even our pets, when they do something we don't like, but your family, your friends, next thing you know, you're angry, and they become part of your whole anger and aversion process, and it's usually because they didn't do something that we wanted. It comes back down to us, which leads us to pride. But with attachment, we over-exaggerate somebody's good qualities. So we, you see that they're the best and they'll never hurt you and that they make you happy and this is going to last forever kind of thing. So pride is grasping at that inherently existing self or that self-cherishing self. So we see that we deserve something that maybe somebody else doesn't deserve, or we should come before somebody else's needs. So it's that really self-cherishing that we have. It can also be you're attached to money, fame, reputation. That's a hard one for most of us here in the West. You know, when somebody says they didn't like what you did or you didn't do a good job, you see it. I mean, you see your reaction immediately. Because I'll be the first to say, well, you know, I say it often. I don't have any pride here. I'll do it. But it's not true, right? We say that stuff. But as soon as somebody says something mean about you, man, it flares. You know, it's right there. We try to protect our happiness, our story, our center, because we are the center of the universe, right? And it revolves around us. And that's really, the Buddha said, that's the basis of our suffering, is that trying to protect that self and that self-cherishing mind of thinking we're the most important person. And then doubt is, indecision is okay, and questioning is okay. So that's not doubt. I hope you do question. I said that the first night. I don't remember if I said it last week. Especially question everything that I'm saying, because I do worry that I'm saying something wrong. But we should always question, no matter who the teacher is. Don't just take somebody's word for it. Examine. Does this fit for you? Does this work for you? Do you believe it? And if you don't, question. You know, just keep questioning until you really do believe it. But this is where you doubt some basic concept. Like in Buddhism, the preciousness of human life is huge. And we will we'll talk about that next week, just how precious this life is and what that means. It's a different concept than we have in the West. But if you start thinking, look, this isn't precious and I don't like myself, and we do things that harm ourselves all the time, right? But when you start doubting what is true, that's doubt. And then wrong view is, some people describe it as heresy, and that's a part of it, or wrong view can be the extreme view, that you, like I said, that ignorance is clinging to this delusion, that, you know, not really seeing how things exist, not really seeing reality. And if you start saying, well, if nothing exists, you know, then nothing exists, so what's the point? And that would be a wrong view when you jump to such an extreme kind of view. So it's more, just over-exaggerating, looking at things in a wrong way. So all of these are in our minds. They're part of our reactions, and the mind can be changed. Like, that's the whole premise of Buddhism. People will say all the time, I'm just an angry person. It's just my habit. It's the way I was brought up. It's who I am. And it's not true. It's our habit now, but those habits can be changed through practice, through, you know, being mindful and aware of our emotions, and then working to change those. And a lot of times, though, they talk about it like poison in water. The poison might be in the water. It's there. It's mixed. But the water is not the poison and can be separated out. There's scientists here and chemists, and they know how you separate things out from other molecules. And it's the same. So you can clean that water of the poison, and then you have pure water. And that's kind of the same thing with this. It's just not part of our trait. They say that it's can be removed. You know, it's just not a permanent part of us, so it can change. So the third noble truth is the truth of the cessation of suffering. These afflictive motions are not inherently part of our mind or our existence, and so we can remove them completely. That's really what nirvana is, and that's one piece of what the Buddha did. You know, he had to remove all those negative obscurations so that he could see the truth. And so nirvana is removing those delusions, those negative obscurations from your mind permanently. And so it's that blissful state that you reach when you do that, where you just have positive states of mind, that it's complete bliss is how it's described. And it's complete freedom from samsara. So you kind of get rid of the dukkha, the suffering that you have. So it can be ended. And the last one is there is a path to end it, to get rid of those obscurations. So there's a path to this cessation of suffering. There's many paths that people take. This is just one. But in this Buddhist tradition, that path is called the Lam Rim, which literally it means path. And the Lam Rim, there's lots of translations from simple teachings. You have volumes of translations that take all these 84,000 teachings of the Buddha and literally do an interpretation on those. And the one that is most often referred to, and we'll talk about this again, but is the 3-volume of the Great Treatise of the Path by Lama Tsongkhapa, who lived in the 13th century. And he did that main translation there. And it presents this whole graduated path to end our suffering. And that's really what we focus on, is that path. The 3 volumes that Lama Tsongkhapa wrote are wonderful. You can get them in Kindle version. You can carry them with you wherever you go. And it's really not hard to understand. You just read them over and over again. Once you finish the 3rd, you go back to the 1st, and you start again, and we'll talk about those again. And the 3 principles aspects of the path, and we'll talk about these next week. This will be the topic. Our renunciation, bodhicitta, and the wisdom of emptiness. And renunciation is where you realize the suffering. You see it even in people that you know have everything. You realize they're suffering. And you want out. You know, that's the bottom line of what renunciation is. You just want to focus on achieving enlightenment. And part of the way is by practicing bodhicitta, which is this immense compassion for all sentient beings. Sentient beings are mind possessors. So any sentient being, from fleas on up to humans. And then the last one is to realize the wisdom of emptiness. Like, you know, Geshe always says, compassion without wisdom isn't really compassion because we don't know what we're doing. And we can do more harm, right? But it's the intention we have. So our intentions are usually good. So we have to work towards realizing this wisdom and how things exist and develop our compassion. And we'll spend time talking about that as well. Questions before I move on. For those who are new or the first time in this class, not that you're new, you do have to talk in the microphone if you want to make a comment or ask a question. Well, yes. I say don't hesitate to interrupt me and ask.
Hello.
You know, like the planes, like the hell and the ghosts and the animals and the humans and demigods and gods. It says, like in like essentials of Buddhism or like fundamentals,
mm-hmm.
It says that each being is born with like difficulties to reach enlightenment, and it says that humans are the easiest to reach enlightenment. Then why did it say on one of your slides that we're not inherently born, or we're not born with inherent, like, ignorance and...
Oh, we are.
We are.
Did it say that? Did it say we're not born with it?
It says it's not inherent.
It's not... Okay. So it's not...
Because I know, like, a big thing in Buddhism is that nothing is inherently dependent.
Existent.
Yeah, yeah.
So this is more that it's not adventitious. It's not who we are. We are this clear, knowing being who has all this ignorance and anger and doubt and everything on top of it. So we're born with it because of our karma. And there is no beginning or end. So we kind of came into this world with the ignorance that we have and the delusions that we have because of our karma. So that's kind of confusing what that inherent means. And it's probably a little more than we're going to cover in this class, but did that help you at all? Think about...
Yeah, I guess like the soul already has like the ignorance and stuff, and then it carries over into a human life or something, I guess.
Kinda. So we are going to talk a little bit about that in a few minutes, and if that doesn't answer your question, then we'll swing back around. Because there isn't, in Buddhism, there isn't, we don't call it a soul. We call it a subtle mind. Now, as a former Catholic, sometimes I think, well, we're really splitting it, you know, hairs here. It's kind of the same, but it's not. Because a soul, when you use the term soul, at least in that Christian Catholicism standpoint, it's an independent, each person's soul is kind of this separate, unique, and it's them. And in Buddhism, there's not such a thing. But we still have a subtle mind that comes into the next world, and it brought us into this world with all the ignorance, attachments, and delusions. And we're going to talk about that, and that might answer your questions.
Sweet.
Good. Thank you. And I'll go back and look at that slide, too. And I may have said it wrong. So thanks for asking that. So we talked about the mind in Buddhism, and we said that mind and consciousness are interchangeable. We said that the brain is physical, the mind is not. So mind, consciousness is separate from the brain. They're not one and the same. And the mind has two qualities. This sense of clear luminosity, this clearness, and awareness. Its whole function is to know. It's taking in through the senses, and it's just constantly analyzing. And the mind is continually changing because of this, which is good. So it's not that we're ever static. It continuously changes. And because of that, we can change our mind. We can change our view of the world. We can eliminate suffering. And I can tell you, just on a mundane level, it's subtle, but you realize it almost immediately that you're not suffering as much. I mean, things happen and you say, eh. Doesn't mean you don't ever get upset, but you just start realizing, just interesting how it happens. So you start controlling your reactions, realize your responsibility for happiness, as well as your own suffering. And now, actually, through neuroscience and neuroplasticity, we know that in changing our mind, in developing these habits, we're actually fundamentally changing the structure of our brain. It's fascinating stuff. So, is that everything I'm going to say? I think so. So when you think about the mind, rebirth and karma are really kind of closely connected to that. And it's important to understand mind non-physical. The mind can only be produced by things that are not physical. So there is the law of cause and effect. We know that scientifically. We witness that. Constantly, there's that law of cause and effect. And Buddhism says you have that physical law of cause and effect, but it's really the same for your mind. There is a law of cause and effect for our minds. And so each moment of mind has to have a previous moment of mind. So we might not realize it, but every thought, every feeling, any of that had a previous moment of mind. And if you just think about coming here tonight and what you had to do to come here, what you had to think about, and then what happened before that to make sure that you got here, you probably had to rearrange meals and get here from work and whatever it was you had to do. Maybe think back and do you remember what you ate for breakfast? Most of us probably remember today. Now think about yesterday, and you probably remember you ate something and you were thinking something while you ate and woke up and went to work or school or anything else you did. So there was thoughts there, and we can probably go back last week, and remember some things we were feeling last week or thinking about. I don't know how far back you can go, but if you go back, just stop for a second, just close your eyes and think about what you were doing 5 years ago. And maybe something significant that happened 5 years ago that you remember, you know, how you felt. 10 years ago. 10 years ago. What about your kindergarten teacher? I was thinking about this today. I can't remember a lot of my teachers, but I vividly remember my kindergarten teacher. And I actually remember what I felt. I know what I felt like to be in her class. So I know I was those feelings there. Some of you might have memories before kindergarten. My husband has vivid memories of his childhood. I have a few. Most of them not good, but I have a few, and those the ones that are really significant you remember, right? But like he can remember being in a crib. Like that's how young he was when he has his first memories. But we know we were in a crib. We know that happened, and we were feeling something, crying and hunger, whatever it might be. We know that happened to us, even if we don't remember it. We also know we all had to be in our mother's womb, right? That's, you know, we had to be there. Now, none of us probably has a recollection of what that was like or what it was like to be born. Some people do, but we know it happened to us. And we know as a little baby we had to have felt something coming out of there. So every moment you can keep going back. So what happened before you were in your mother's womb? You know, what happened at conception? What happened then? Where was that conscious being? And then if you believe in Buddhism and at conception that mind entered, there was a moment of mind before that. So there, and you can keep going back and back and back. And we learned that from the Buddha. He went back and back and back through all his lives. Most of us don't remember our past lives. But there are studies done, University of Virginia, I can't remember the professor's name, he's been studying this for a couple of decades now, because kids can remember, they can remember their past lives. There was actually a little boy who took his new family, he had vivid memories of this farm and of being killed. And his parents were fine, like, all right, you know, and they looked some stuff up. They found this farm. They took this boy to the farm. And the parents said, yeah, our son was killed. I forget how old he was when he was killed. The parents were still alive. And the boy took them to the body and knew who killed him. And that's true. It's a true story. So there are those, and there is one story after another from this professor who's been studying this for so long. Scientific, quantifiable research study. So it's not like it sounds pretty woo-woo just to say it, but it's not like some woo-woo stuff out there. I mean, it's really going on. It's really happening. We had somebody who She was a college student. She started coming here. This was many years ago. But they were in Greece. She was in Greece with her family. She was from Greek. Her family was from Greece. None of them had ever been there. So they went for a visit, and they got lost. And I can't remember the whole story. Anyhow, they were lost. It was really scary. They couldn't find where they were going. They didn't have phones. They couldn't get help. None of them could speak the language. And she said, "Oh, I know where we are." And she literally would say, "Turn left here, turn right here. There's going to be this big red house on the end of the street," and whatever, all this detail. And it freaked her out so much, she found Buddhism to think, what was that all about and where did that come from? Oh, hang on, sorry.
Actually, I have a recent recollection of something like that. So last year we were in Geneva, and I traveled with my family, my husband, my daughter, who is now 4 and a half. Then she was 4. She had turned 4. Actually, she was going to turn 4 1 week after we came back from Geneva. So my best friend lived there. She's a shaman. And so this was kind of interesting because, she's a shaman, and I'm going with my daughter and my son, who then was like 1.5 years old. And my daughter Marina is walking in the Geneva. He's like, "Yeah, I've been here. But we were not really paying much attention. I'm like, and then she said, "The water fountain." And I'm like, "I'm not paying attention. I'm ignoring her. I'm listening, but I'm like, okay, yeah, whatever."
Right, water fountain, uh-huh.
And then when we got to the jet door, which is this big, very impressive jet of water in the middle of Geneva, in this big lake, which is pretty impressive for a young child. I mean, it was impressive for me when I saw it, being an adult. She's like, "Yes, I have been here. I've been here." And it was so just a pun. It was so natural for her to just say it, right? "Yeah, I've been here." My best friend looked at me. She has been here.
She knew.
And she knew it was talking. And it was the first time I had an experience like that.
And this professor in Virginia says, if you can get kids young enough, they do remember. Then as they get older, now not all of us do, but some children do. And then as they get older, they forget. So he captures these stories when they're young. And some people hear that story and they say, "Oh, yeah, right. You've been here. Deja vu, right? Oh, that's just deja vu." And we just, and see, your friend knew. You knew. They've been here. So that's the continuity of consciousness, that belief in rebirth. And we'll come back to that again in a second. And the Buddha really, he got rid of his obscurations. He knew. Like, he didn't go back because he said it's beginningless, right? But he knew to go back far enough to know that it was beginningless. So it's this subtle level of consciousness that goes on. And we'll talk about that in a second. Did you have a question or a comment?
This may be just, I don't know, a silly question, but...
No, silly question. Unless I can't answer it. No, go ahead.
is the mind leaving someone at the same, is it, it's leaving somebody at the same time that it's entering someone else?
Oh, that's a good question. And we are going to have a class on death and dying. I think it's next week. I'm not positive. It's next week or the week after. I think it's next week. So we are going to talk about that. Usually not. For most of us, it can take anywhere from 7 to 49 days once your mind leaves this body, before it enters another one. But there are people that can do it pretty quick. And there are high enough beings that, like Lama Yeshe, planned who he was. He knew his mother and he knew his next mother and father. So when you're a high enough being, you can plan. And he came back right away. That's what happened. But most of us, no, we just kind of get bounced into something.
So if your karma goes over to your next life. First history question, did the Buddha become a Buddha at the end of his life or during the middle of his life?
That's a good question. So He was in his 30s.
When he became a Buddha?
When he became a Buddha. But many believe he was a Buddha before and just... so he could quickly realize that in this life.
Oh.
So okay. It could be either. But he was in his early 30s. A lot of similarities between Buddha and Jesus, early 30s.
Yeah, I know.
But yes, so that's a good question.
Well, that led me to another question. Like, if you spend one life giving, like, 110% to becoming enlightened, and you get, like, 99% there, and then you just die, would your, like, reincarnation have that 99%, or would you have to start all over?
That's my question. I'm not starting over. So there's, I encourage you to study more and to take Discovering Buddhism, but the quick answer is, depends on your karma. So we're in this life with seeds ripening because of causes and conditions. So the hope is, and Geshe-la has said, you know, when you get far enough along, my fear is I'm coming back as a cockroach and having to start all over again. And, you know, it's highly likely that's going to happen. And he says, no, you got so far. Chances are good. But, yeah, not from what I'm reading. They're not so good. But so you get 99%. You've gotten nirvana. Like, you know bliss. You've even gotten glimpses of emptiness. And then you hit by a bus. I want to know though. I'm going to come back with bliss and emptiness. but what if I can't think of a good example. What if I was Hitler, and I got lucky right now, but my next life that those seeds might ripen, and I might come back as a cockroach. Now chances are I'm going to move through that quickly if I got this far, but there's no guarantee. Karma is really, really deep. We're going to talk about karma tonight, and that'll give you an idea. But yeah, it's a good question.
So the inherent thing that I was talking about was on the third noble truth slide.
It was on the third noble truth. And what did it say? I'll look.
I remember.
Yeah, I'll look.
So you were talking about how at the time of conception, that's like when the mind enters. Are there any general, like this might be getting too political, but are there any general Buddhist views on abortion because of that?
So that's a good question, and we'll kind of, it'll come up again in karma. So there is no judgment. I just want to say that. Never. So there's no judgment, but it would be killing, right? And we're going to talk about killing. So it's killing when you have an abortion. And so then you have to do things to purify or make up for that killing. But we kill constantly. We kill all the time with our cars. We kill bugs intentionally. We harm other people. So we do lots of things. So the abortion, you get used, that changes for you too, believe me, as an insect phobic person. But that would be considered killing for whatever intentions that could be good. You can't see anybody's mind because we all have those good intentions, right? But we'll talk about that again with karma.
I mean, wasn't there a Tibetan story about the mass murderer that killed like over 30 people, and then he ended up reaching enlightenment just by meditating the rest of his life?
That's right. Yeah, you never milarepa. Yeah, and he killed many people, and he put spells on people so that. Oh, a terrible man. And he became enlightened in the same lifetime. And then there's a story about the Buddha who he was on a ship. He was just a regular person on a ship. And the captain was going to kill all these people. What's that story?
I think he was the ship's captain.
He was the ship's captain. And he killed who? He killed somebody because he knew that person was going to kill everybody. So he killed somebody. He actually went to the hell realms, but he killed that person to stop them from killing people, right? That was close enough to the story. Thank you. Were you going to... Did somebody else have their hands?
I mean, I don't think we set side channels. I mean, I could think it all the time, but I don't...
But I was, when you were talking about the uniqueness of the soul, that kind of confused me, because it's, you know, you say that, you know, I was also raised Catholic, and yes, the soul is something unique.
That's right.
But then when we talk about Buddhism, we talk about the mind, you know, is not the mind something unique to me? So I'm a little bit confused with the uniqueness of mind versus soul.
We'll talk about that in a second. We'll talk about that, and that might answer. But if not, ask me again. Yes. I mean, the soul is seen as, like, you're gonna, when you die, your soul goes to heaven, and it's you. And in Buddhism, there's that's no such person. So there is no you that's going anywhere. It's a subtle consciousness, which we'll get to. All right. And it's that continuity of consciousness that goes on. Okay. So two definitions, just kind of quickly. One is rebirth, and what is it that goes on, which is that subtle energy. So we have this gross level of consciousness that we live in all the time, and then you have a level of a second level of consciousness that when you meditate and we quiet it down. Who was it that talked about the chatter in our head? When we finally quiet down that chatter in our head and we finally shut out the noise and we clear our mind, we can get glimpses of that, you know, the mind like the sky and that clear luminosity. And then we have this third level, which is this really subtle level of consciousness. There's more levels than this. And that's that pure, clear nature of mind. And this is what is reborn. This is that continuity of consciousness. So in Buddhism or Christianity, when you talk about a soul, in Buddhism, that continuity of consciousness, that subtlest level of consciousness that goes on, is it's not Karen that goes on. So it's not Karen with my personality and my stale jokes, thank goodness, that are just going to stay here. It's this very subtle consciousness of my karma that goes on. And so will I know in my next life that I was 99% there and now I'm back as a cockroach? No, that's the good news. You're just back as a cockroach and you forgot it. It's bad news for us after working so hard, but the good news is it's not like we're like, oh, you know. it just kind of happens. So it's a little, that makes it a little different than a soul. And then samsara, you hear that, thank you. And actually, thank you very much, and I'll use another cough drop. I even came prepared. I opened a few. Of course, I went, there they are. Thank you. So samsara is that cyclic existence. It's born, aging, dying, being reborn. And it's that very subtle level of consciousness that goes through that. We call that samsara, that pervasive suffering, that third level of suffering that we talked about. And the thought is having a human rebirth is the best because we get to practice. You know, we get to practice how do we get out of samsara. We can contemplate, we're aware, we can think, we can observe our own thoughts, we can change our mind in realizing that suffering and happiness is within us and we can change that. Take this as your hypothesis. Remember, not convincing you of anything, just Geshe always says, for information purposes only. But that is one of the Buddhist hypotheses. All closely tied to karma. And the karma we had to even... all right. Find the center and be here. Oh, good. I thought I did something. Find the center and be here. Do something. All right, let me just see. Okay. So, good. Karma's a popular topic in the West, right? And we use it kind of flippantly. You know, we'll say, oh, that's my karma, or that's his karma, or whatever. Instant karma's going to get you, and, you know. So we say things lightly. So we kind of get karma on some levels. But it's a really, really deep topic. Steve was saying that he's in a 3-month class just on karma. And 3 months is just going to touch the subject of karma. People can study karma for decades. So I won't even pretend to have an understanding of it. But this will give you just at least a very introductory level, because it really is very deep. And it's really key to Buddhism. It's that key to changing our mind and really making sure that we're practicing virtuous karma and eliminating non-virtuous karma. And all karma means, simple term, it means action. That's the only thing karma means. Venerable Rabina, who is one of the Western nuns, who does come visit here. She's from Australia, but she travels all over the place now. I think I mentioned her before. She's awesome. She's a real fireball. Good to come listen to her when she comes again. But she defines it as intention. She'll say it's intention, then intention or action. And karma results from actions of body, speech, or mind. So it's what we do with our bodies. It's the words we say. It's what we think, which is the scariest one of all. And they're called the three doors of Buddhism, our body, speech, and mind. Three doors of Buddhism. So every action of body, speech, and mind leaves an imprint on our mind. Imprint, some people call it a seed, is left on your mind. Every action of body, speech, and mind. So this is easy to think about if you think about an analogy of music or sports. If you want to learn a musical instrument, you practice it, you get really good at it, and then, you know, that becomes your habit. So that, you know, through all this practice and hard work, you see the fruits of that. And it takes time, right? It's those actions that left that impression on the mind that allowed that to happen. If you believe in rebirth, when you see these little kids who can play instruments when they're 3-4 years old, you know, then you start thinking, they practiced that, you know, in a past life before they got here. So every action leaves this impression or seed, and every action produces a result. Remember that law of cause and effect. You can't have an action without producing that result that we will experience in the future. So what you're saying and doing in this life, you can almost predict what you're going to be in your next life, because this is the subtle consciousness that you're taking care of right now that's going to go on. And you can actually look at your life now and almost think about what whoever had your subtle consciousness in the past, you know, what karma and seeds that they planted for you to be here right now and find this center, especially when you were young. So you might have been at 99% in your last life and coming now. We often think of karma as bad. We think of that law of cause and effect as bad. But there's good karma too, right? And we do good karma all the time. So it's good and bad. It's not random. It's not luck. It's not a coincidence. Every action has a cause. So it's really important when you think about what karma is and what it isn't. One of our teachers, Venerable Tendrin, she's not here right now. She's teaching in Florida. She's coming back soon for a visit, and I understand she might end up teaching there for another year. But I've heard her say that there is no scoreboard in the sky. It's not like somebody's keeping track. Oh, one black mark, one gold mark. I mean, there's no scorekeeper. There's no judgment. It's, you know, as Catholics, it was little black X's on your soul. You know, the bigger the X, the heavier the sin was. And it's not that, but it it's similar. It's that seed that's planted on that subtle level of consciousness that is there. So you don't have to keep track. Because here's the thing with karma. There's four laws of karma. And there's four aspects of karma as well. I wanted to make sure I didn't forget anything. All right. I probably did, but that's all right. So if you think about karma, everything we're experiencing now, the colors we see and like, the food we like, the world that we have created out there is because of our past karma. Maybe some karma from this life, but most of it's past karma. You don't often see instant karma. The only time you see instant karma is if you're really generous or if you did something really wrong. So like a teacher or a Buddha. If you harm your teacher, you harm a Buddha, you can have instant karma right now. But most of us, it'll ripen whenever the causes and conditions are okay. And again, if you do something extremely generous, you can become Milarepa, you can become enlightened just like that in this life. So it can happen. But it's interesting, when bad things happen, it's when the woe is me happens, where you think, why does this happen to me? Woe is me. We never question when good things happen. We think, of course, you know, like if you win the lottery or you make a lot of money, you never really think, why did I make a lot of money? Like, why? What's wrong? I won the lottery. Like, we're never upset about that kind of stuff. We just think, oh, of course, we're good. It's me. But when something goes wrong, then we kind of think about karma. That truly is both. So, I need to stop talking with my hands. So the four laws of karma are: karma's definite, it expands over time, there is no result without a cause, and karma's never lost. So karma being definite, virtuous actions always produce virtuous results or happiness, always. Non-virtuous actions always produce future suffering. Always. Doing something good can never result in something in bad karma for you. And doing a non-virtuous action, unless you're a Buddha, you know why you're doing that non-virtuous action, it doesn't result in something good. So you think about it on a physical realm, and we get that, right? You can't plant an apple seed and a lemon tree grows. Only an apple tree is going to grow if you plant an apple seed. So it's that same kind of view. Karma expands over time. So when you're generous, it can produce great wealth. When you do something non-virtuous, like anger, it can produce huge suffering. That's the part I don't like. So then always be generous, because then you want that to grow, you know, and expand. But when I'm angry, I think, oh my gosh, that karma is going to expand as well. And then there's no result without the cause. You will never experience a result for which you didn't create the cause. Never. Can happen. So if something happens to you, you created the cause for that to happen. And if you do something good or something bad, negative, you created the cause to do that as well. So everything we experience was caused by our past actions. We may experience something as a group. We're all here right now. We're experiencing that as a group. Or you think about the tsunami that hit, or, you know, a hurricane. But that just means that we all had the karma to experience that tsunami, and we all could have had some connection that caused us to experience it together. Doesn't mean that connection was from the same karma in the past. But it probably does mean we had some connection to even be here. I could have been a mother bird feeding you guys, or we could have been cockroach buddies, or, you know, we could have been friends in a past life, who knows. So we had that group karma to meet each other in here. But our subtle consciousness experienced that to get us here.
Quick question. So, and you might not know the answer, but I'm curious. So does the act, is it kind of congruent to what the result is? Like, if I killed a cockroach and that was non-virtuous, and then, my mom dies. Terrible example. Mom's alive and kicking.
Right.
But, and then, if I do something good, if I pick up litter, I'm winning the lottery. Does the bad have to equal the bad that happens to you and the good has to equal the, or does it, is there any kind of rule or
kind of, yes, and we're going to talk about those rules next. Those are the aspects.
Fantastic.
But it probably isn't going to happen in this life. So if you killed a cockroach in this life, it doesn't mean when your mom dies or something bad happens and you think it's because I killed that cockroach. No, and remember, there's no judgment. There's no punishment. Karma isn't a punishment. But if you kill a cockroach, or whatever you kill, you've created that habit to kill. And then you've created the cause to be killed. It's your karma, not your mom dying. You can't cause somebody else's karma, only your own. Yes.
And what happens if, for my ignorance, I make a non-virtuous action?
That's right.
Do I get karma, even though it's, I don't know?
You do, because that's an action, right? But it's much lighter. We kill all the time. Anybody who drove their car here tonight killed a whole mess of insects coming here. But we didn't have the intentions to run over a worm or kill something. That was not our intention. And intention is the huge piece of that. Now, I know people who have driven with Lama Zopa Rinpoche, the person on the left up there. And if it's raining out, he will stop his car and have people get out and move all the worms before they drive. Yeah, true story. But for the rest of us, I have this nice little mantra on my car window that's supposed to, all the bugs that hit my windshield, it's supposed to whatever, give them some sort of blessing so that maybe they'll come back enlightened. Who knows? Because we do. We kill when we walk, right?
So essentially, is it essentially inevitable then? So I'm kind of living off the karma of my past mind. So anything I do in this life is going to help me in the future, but it's not going to do anything for me right now.
Oh, sure.
Not that I wouldn't be a nice person because of that, but just out of curiosity.
Yeah. No, sure it will. So we know that now, right? We know when you do nice things happen. And we feel good, right? And there are things we can change our past karma. We can lessen it. We can stop the causes and conditions from a seed ripening. But the goal is not to create any more. So that if our tendency is to kill cockroaches, been there, just holy cow, we can stop that tendency, right? And then we can stop killing. Were you going to add to that?
Yes, I think it's important that we don't think about karma as being fatalistic.
That's good.
And not look in the past. Karma is about the future. Karma is about the seeds that we're planting
to go
now,
forward.
And these are going to ripen later.
That's good.
And I think even Hindus, which karma is part of the Hindu practice too, even some Hindus misinterpret karma. It is not fatalistic. It is not something that you can't do anything about.
That's right. And you're not being punished. There's no judgment. It's not fatalistic, and you can't change your past. You can only change what we're doing now to be better. There's somebody behind you, and then you can keep moving it up.
I don't know if this will make any sense, but Christians would probably say if something bad happens or whatever that it was an act of God. In Buddhism, is it something with the universe, or is karma its own separate entity, or is it something in our subconscious? What is it that causes karma, I guess is what I'm asking.
So what is that's for that 3-month class. So I don't know. I've actually asked that question before, just because, where did it come from? If it's beginningless, then where was the beginning of this? And there is no beginning, right? So it's hard to get, we get it with math, Any mathematicians in here? You know infinity, right? You know you can always add another number, subtract another number, we get it. It's no different with this, but now why was I going there? Ask your question again. Go ahead.
Well, and then too, it's like we were talking in the lobby. So if you think about karma, trying to imagine something that exists without a prior cause. Anything that you can imagine that exists without a prior cause. And I don't think you can, I don't think you'll think of anything. So karma affects everything. Everything has a prior cause. So it's whether or not as Karen said, there's not a scorekeeper. There's not a celestial scorekeeper or someone looking down that's keeping score. This is in your consciousness. These are seeds that you're planting in your mind stream.
And it's not in the universe. So our karma created our universe, right? So we're all looking here and we all see colors. Now some of you might say, well, that's an ugly color of yellow. And some might say that's the most beautiful color I've seen. And some might say, I love this in here. And somebody else might say, this is really gaudy, right? So we're all in the same room, but we've created a different view of this because of our karma. So it's not like it's out there in the universe. My husband kept getting all green lights. No matter, anytime he got in the car, he was getting all green lights. And he said to Geshe-la, I think I've just used all my green light karma. And Geshe-la said, green lights don't have anything to do with karma. You know, it's not like it's out there. So, yeah, that's not what karma is, right? Yes.
So I guess the part that I'm getting confused on is we're saying that karma is like you control it, or you don't control, but you contribute to your own karma. And for me, I'm wondering if Buddhism would kind of look at more of a human nature karma that everyone kind of contributes to on some level, because I think that we'd all agree there's things that happen in the world that we wouldn't say, you know, my family contributed, or like I wouldn't, I guess in my head I'm thinking of cancer and like,
oh, good.
If that happens to someone in my family, I don't think that all of our combined karmas kind of contributed to we're going to...
You can't, right?
Suffer, right? But so I'm wondering if there's just more of a like a worldly kind of karma that...
There is not. So actually, that's a really good question. So if you think about it in terms of cancer, the people we know and love who have cancer, because of their karma, not necessarily that's why they got cancer, but for whatever karma, they got a disease. Lama Yeshe had cancer, and he manifested cancer is what we say, and he used that as a teaching of how you handle it, what you do, and that the body is frail, it gets cancer. But that's that person's karma, right? Your karma was to experience that suffering with that person. So that's your karma, but not their cancer. The two are not linked, if that makes any sense. It often comes up with abortion. Was that mother murdering that baby? Their karmas are connected, right? That baby was born and killed, and the mother did that, but it wasn't like that they shared that karma. It was cause and effect of their karma. They were two separate karmas, okay? So it's not like just because you know somebody with cancer that you're part of that. But if we were experiencing a tsunami, we're all in this room experiencing that tsunami together. No cause, no punishment, no judgment. We just happen. So here's the other thing. When that tsunami hit, people picked up and went on with their lives, right? And they knew that this was karma. Many of them were practicing Buddhism. Here, when Katrina hit, the results weren't the same because we see an injustice and judgment and punishment around that. It's a collective experience, but it's just different. It just happens to be a collective experience. Oh, yep, you and then behind you, if you like.
So if I kill somebody in previous life, can karma skip life? Like, the, is it gonna, is everything from a previous life gonna manifest in this life, or could it be like any life, like later on?
It could be any life later on. So it doesn't mean if you killed somebody in your last life that you're going to experience the result of that karma now. Depends on the causes and conditions that allow that seed to ripen. But maybe before the last life, you know, this is a bad example. I was going to say you were Mother Teresa, but maybe somebody like Mother, maybe you were Mahatma Gandhi. So you were Gandhi, but in your last life you were born, you killed somebody, but this life you got it pretty good. And then your next life, that karma might ripen for when you murdered somebody. So it's karma, it's not a linear cause and effect is the best way I could explain that.
Can karma have multiple effects?
Give
like
me.
If you, it says actions always produce a result unless the karmic imprints are purified or destroyed. Does that mean one karmic action or imprint can cause multiple effects? Like if, I guess.
That's a good question. I don't think so. Karma, it's just one. Like it's one action, one effect. It's just like the law and effect of the universe, right? Maybe it could.
How could it expand if it's probably not, then how could it expand if it's going to have one effect?
So if you're generous, you practice generosity, that good karma expands is how it's been explained to me. And if you're angry, you can wipe out good karma like that, wipe it all out. It can expand that greatly. Now, I can't explain to you why it expands, but that's a good question.
Well, and another way to think of it, when something does happen that's causing you some dissatisfaction, and Geshe Sangpo and I were talking about this, like if you have a toothache,
right?
I'm relieved. I'm happy about this toothache because this is purifying some karma. Some seed I planted in some lifetime has ripened in this toothache, but it was able to be repaired. I didn't have to have a root canal. It wasn't cancer. And so whatever that issue was that created this toothache has now been
purified. So that's bad and good karma because you could get treatment. Geshe Sangpo is wonderful that. I went over to visit. I had fallen. I broke an arm and two ribs. I could barely take a breath, couldn't cough. And Geshe Sangpo, the first thing he said to me is, "I rejoice for you." And I was like, oh, it never even occurred to me to rejoice. But because I got rid of that negative karma and I could get treatment. I'm in a country where I could take pain pills and have a cast and get treatment.
If he told you the story of one of his teachers, he was riding a moped and one of his teachers got hit. While riding a moped and broke his leg.
Oh.
But there was a celebration in the hospital room.
They celebrate. They celebrate when somebody gets hurt. And for those who couldn't hear that in the recording, it was one of his teachers who got hit while riding a moped and broke both legs, and they celebrated in the hospital. That's great.
Can your karma be intertwined with another person? Say that you did something with that other person in your previous life.
Bless you.
And then would you come back with that person or anything like that?
Oh, yes, you would come back with that person. We all came back, but probably not the way you're thinking of it. So it's not necessarily intertwined. It's your karma and their karma. You both could have killed somebody at the same time. So you have that common action that you committed, but the two of you may ripen in completely different ways. But I'll get the story wrong, and we're almost out of time, but the old man who looks in the window and sees a woman eating a fish, and he realizes it's the woman's son, and they kick the dog, and the dog was her husband or whatever. He could see all these karmic connections. So most people in your lives you had some connection to in the past that can get kind of weird when you think about it, but you know, your partner could have been your mother or your father in a past life, or your enemy, or who knows. Look, if you all don't mind, I'm happy to keep taking questions, and then we can continue this discussion next week. But go ahead.
you keep talking, I keep coming up with questions. Okay, so it's probably, I know that we said that it's not fatalistic and it's not like something like if we killed somebody or if we were super great in one life that it's necessarily going to pursue something bad here. It's probably safe to assume, if you believe in rebirth, that I was probably both a Teresa in one life and a serial killer in another.
That's right. We all were.
So I feel like there's always like that mix of good and bad. So when you talk about karma, like the seeds being ready, like being in a time to like kind of manifest that karma, is that kind of what we're putting in the present? Like because I'm a good person now, it's like it's not ripened for the bad portion of me to come out. Like does that make sense?
It makes sense, but probably what we're there's, you know, instant karma, it, bless you, it really isn't such a thing. So what we're doing in this life is going to manifest in the future. But we are changing those seeds, right? So we are purifying, we are getting rid of some of these negative seeds, and so we are helping in that way. And so I was going to talk for a second about purification, and I'll just mention it now. And you go through this little ritual, and then, you know, one of those is that so you're looking at, like lay in bed at night and you think, what are all the negative things I did? First, one way or the other, you want to think about the positive. But if you think about, I shouldn't have yelled at that person, or I shouldn't have judged this, or I shouldn't have killed that cockroach, or whatever it is we did, and you regret that and you purify it, but then you want to think back, in my past life, I know I raped and killed and robbed and lied and stole, you know, all those things that we did in our past lives, and you can purify that now too. So you can think, you can go through that purification practice for your past life too, not just this life. And then that helps with the seeds of karma that are going to ripen later too. Maybe prevent them from ripening.
So when the Buddha achieved enlightenment, was it essentially kind of releasing him from any kind of karmic cycles, or was he kind of like, or in other words, when you achieve enlightenment, is it no more karma, or are you kind of just seeing karma or like creating it, but it's not affecting you, or do they have
good
any
question
kind of understanding of how that works? Or
it ends. And so once you achieve complete enlightenment, and we're Buddhas, no more karma, no more delusions, no more suffering.
Would that hypothetically accelerate the death of the body, though? Because
no.
Oh, okay.
Nope, it doesn't. Your body can go on, and the Buddha did, right? He went on for 40 years after that. There's probably Buddhas in this room right now. Who knows? You don't know. But you can stay in a human form to teach, to prevent suffering. For lots of reasons, a Buddha would continue. So it doesn't mean you leave this body. I would. I'd be like, I'm out of here. Oh, one more. Okay. Thank you for waiting.
So if he reached enlightenment in his 30s and then he continued to teach until he passed into nirvana and he stopped the karmic cycle, if he's in his human form, is he not walking around killing ants? Like,
no, the Buddha wouldn't do that.
I mean, like, accidentally.
Well, yeah, you think when the Buddha lived. I don't like that question. Well, he wouldn't get the, I don't know. No, because he can't create any more. Go ahead, what were you going to say? I think he was elevated. If he was enlightened, he was floating. No, I'm kidding.
And he's like free of karma, like free of attachment. Like, wouldn't that mean, you know, if he's doing that he's already free from that? But not necessarily based up. You know, I can't care.
I get it. I get what you're saying. And I will ask one of our teachers that question. No, the Buddha can't accrue any negative, non-virtuous actions. He can't. He completely eliminated them. So I don't know what he ate. Bathing. We kill things bathing all the time. But the Buddha was above that. So I think that anything that he killed probably achieved instant enlightenment.
Right.
I don't know. What?
No, I agree. I think that's probably true. That's right.
I mean, there's stories about flies that flew around the Buddha in the stupa and became enlightened. But that's a good question, and I'll ask before next week.
Maybe it was like an aura.
It's an aura and nothing gets harmed. That's what I said. He floated. No, I'm kidding. I'm kidding. Okay.
Sorry.
Does anybody have a problem with this? Okay. Because we're late. It's 8:35. I just wanted you all to realize that if you had child care or anything. Good.
If karma ends, does that mean that your subtle mind doesn't move on? Like, does it pass again?
So you're in bliss, so it's this complete state of bliss, but Buddhas come back all the time. So they can target where they want their subtle consciousness to go. So they can come back. But otherwise, they never leave. So there's not a place in the sky that we go to when we become a Buddha. And there's not a hell realm below us where we go when we kill too many cockroaches. There are hell realms, and there are these bliss realms. Thank you. Good night. There are these bliss realms, but they're here. They're right here. We might cross universes because there's multiple universes, right? And science has proven that. Buddhists have taught that all along. But they're all within this realm. We just can't see them.
So they pick a bliss realm and that person is enlightened as well, so they don't have karma attached to them?
Who's that?
Like, so if the person that achieved karma then passes in their subtle mind, moves to somebody else.
Karma goes with them.
But there's a no karma. I thought the karma.
Oh, they're already enlightened.
So if they're already enlightened, then like this non-enlightened person just keeps floating with no karma ever being attached to them?
That's correct.
Okay.
Once you're enlightened, even though you come back as an ant or you come back in the hell realms, you are not accruing any other karma. You came back because you had a reason. So that's why we use the term Lama Yeshe manifested cancer. Lama Zopa Rinpoche manifested a stroke. Because if you're a Buddha, which most people believe that they're at least a holy being, if not a Buddha, or it's holiness, and he's aging, he's had surgery, he has suffered, and they're manifesting that because as a Buddha, you can't. You can't suffer like that. They're not really suffering. They're doing it to teach us something.
I thought that the end goal of enlightenment was to escape samsara.
It is.
The will.
That's right.
So if you escape the will, wouldn't your mind just be endlessly floating around the will?
I don't know. Your mind doesn't endlessly float around the will. It probably just says, we're done with that wheel.
Okay, well, if it leaves, then how... If you can control it, then why would you go back to human?
Because you want to help the rest of us get out of samsara. Good night. You want to help the rest of us get out of samsara. If they come back, they can come back as a dog. They can come back as a lion, an ant, a cockroach, a lover. They're coming back to teach us something. And we don't know who they could be.
Bodhisattvas.
So with samsara, it's like there's a finite number of minds, right?
No.
There's
well,
not.
Mm-mm.
Well, then what? Like, if the population is like limitless, then there shouldn't be a finite number of minds. Shouldn't they be continuously created? Then
they are kind of well.
Right.
That's
right.
Good question. So there's not. There's not one universe, right? So it seems like there's populations greater than ever, right? Where did we all come from? If it was beginningless and endless, and so we came from flea. Look at all the fleas and insects and bacteria that we don't even know about yet. And then it's multiple universes. So there's minds coming in and out all the time. Did that answer your question?
There's a lot of conflicting things going on there.
Yeah, there can be. There can be. And I'll think of a better answer for that. All right, one more. Are you guys okay? It's 20 till. Okay. You're cool. One more question, and then And then maybe I'll finish this slide. But this is all awesome, so this is good.
I was going to ask how, like, if a mind has had past lives, so it could
have
existed, if it's existed in the past, in the present, and the future, could it exist in the present and multiple lives simultaneously? So
we
in other
can't.
Words, could the mind be bigger than just our mind, but we experience kind of one view through our body or whatever, but that would be the answer to his question on, like, the size of people versus the, like, the mind. Not enough minds, too many bodies, but, like, each mind being maybe, you know, more complex and intertwined with multiple lives, kind of making it more plural than singular?
No, it's singular. So we have this subtle mind in this universe right now. But if any of you are Buddha, you could be sitting here listening, trying to get me on the straight and narrow, and you could be in another universe helping somebody who's dying of cancer or whatever. So a Buddha could. We can't. It's one mind. It's one subtle mind, and it's stuck in Stephanie Smith, who's teaching karma right now. She describes it as, we're the custodian of this body, like a hotel room. So we're stuck in this hotel room right now. We're the custodian. What do we want to do to take care of this hotel room for the next life? So we can't go into multiple hotel rooms. We can only stay in one. We have one body. So are we going to mess it up and junk it up and not care? Because who cares? We're going to have a good time, and we're not going to know anyhow in that next life. Or are we going to set it up so that the next person has a nice, clean hotel room to stay in, and it's fresh, and it's nicely painted, and they have a good start in life? And so we're caretakers. We're caretakers of our future in this life and our future in our next life. This was awesome. This was one of the most stimulating discussions I've had in any of the classes I taught. And so thank you. Very challenging. And I hope I remember some of the questions. I should have written it down because I wanted to remember your question that I couldn't answer. Your question that I couldn't answer at all. Oh, how did he not create karma? Thank you. Somebody will probably have to remind me of that. Yeah. All right. So the last one on this slide is karma is never lost. And then we'll end. But the action always produces a result, always, always. There is no expiration date. So it's not like when you go to confession and, you know, you worry that maybe you didn't confess everything, or if you confess that it's gone. And if I said that I lied 5 times, but I really lied 6, who's going to know? Yeah, it's there. That action created is there. It was created, and it's never lost. There's no expiration date unless we purify that imprint, or we destroy it or limit its potential somehow, which we can do. All right. So we'll talk about the aspects of karma next time and the non-virtuous actions. Ooh. Well, you know, we keep catching up, so it's good. And we have plenty of time to catch up. We'll catch up. Because I do want to talk about the aspects of karma and how you purify. So we'll do that next week. We'll talk about precious human rebirth, the Buddhist view of death and dying, which was also a question here, is, you know, where do you go and how long are you there and when do you come back? We're going to talk about the 3 scopes of the Lam Rim and the 3 principal aspects of the Lam Rim, the 3 principal aspects of the path. For those who don't have my email and want it, I'm happy to give it to you. As other questions come up, email me or write them down and remember them for next week. And then we'll come back to this. We'll talk a little bit more about karma and we'll come back. So nobody hurry home. Take your time. Be careful. And I appreciate you sticking in here. And this was very fun. I was going to go home and go straight to bed, and now I'm not going to be able to because of you. I'm going to be all keyed up. Good night. Oh, wait. Dedicate. Just take 1 second as you're getting up and think about this awesome conversation, because you want to make sure this karmic seed that we have planted, cover it with dirt, make sure it's going to grow, water it. We want it to keep growing and growing, that we keep asking questions, we keep learning, dedicate it, that we can continue on this path for our own enlightenment and that of all other people. Sentient beings, not just people, all sentient beings. Don't kill any cockroaches tonight. Good night.
I promise.
Good.